collaboration with the community in a real meaningful way, which means you're not always in charge, is important. I think the same thing is true with physicians, nurses, and other clinical folks. You've got to make them feel a part of this. If they view their job as just to produce RVUs and deliver services, as opposed to delivering health or producing health, it's going to be hard for them to really understand, why do I need to spend so much time and effort on this? And I think in our organization, we've done a really good job of making it relevant to folks. We have health improvement teams throughout the organization that bring clinicians to the table to talk about how we do more of what we already do well and how we do better at what we don't. Leaders have come from a lot of unexpected places in the organization to make that happen.
Welcome to A&M Healthcare Industry Group's What's Your Moonshot podcast series, where world-class healthcare leaders seek to solve big problems. Listen as we talk to today's health system CEOs about the journey to achieve their moonshots.
Welcome to A&M's What's Your Moonshot podcast series. I'm Chris George, a managing director in the Healthcare Industry Group, and I lead our health system practice. I'm joined by my co-host, Dr. David Shulkin, 9th Secretary of the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs and an A&M advisor. Today, we are thrilled to be joined by Tony Keck, Executive Vice President for System Innovation and Chief Population Health Officer at Ballad. In his role, Tony is responsible for strategic planning and analytics, corporate development, the Ballad Health Innovation Institute, and Ballad Ventures, as well as behavioral health, community health, and Ballad Early Learning Centers, marketing and communications, patient experience, and digital front door. In addition, enterprise project management and operational excellence in the Ballad Health Foundation. Ballad Health is a 20-hospital system in Northeast Tennessee and Southwest Virginia with $2.3 billion in revenue, over 3 million patient contacts, and 85,000 inpatient discharge annually with over 12,000 employees. Welcome, and we're looking forward to a great discussion.
Thanks for having me.
Tony, we're so glad you could be here. As you know, this is really a podcast that is directed to other healthcare leaders. And what we're focused on is people who have big ideas, who want to change the healthcare world and, you know, really make it a much more effective place. So you have such an interesting perspective on this, given your role over population health and the work that you're doing. So tell us about something that you're working on that really is important to you, that you want to make a lasting impact on the healthcare system.
Sure, absolutely. Well, you know, my CEO, Alan Levine, and I were both health secretaries in our prior lives. And so we firmly believe that 80% of health is driven by everything else but healthcare services. And so income, education, social supports, the environment. But we both worked as payers before, and we both worked in provider sectors before. I've been here for 10 years now. And we also believe that 25 to 30% of all healthcare spending is waste, right? So if you're really going to move the needle, you've got to be able to eliminate waste and start to shift these dollars into program services that improve access, improve quality, but also address health-related social needs and social determinants of health. That's pretty scary when you tell folks in a health system that they're going to be responsible for community health. They're usually focused on the patient right in front of them. But there's a lot of reasons for that, mostly because we haven't given them the tools in the past to actually help address a lot of these issues that they know are affecting their patients' lives. That's where we come to, I guess, what we might call our two moonshots at Ballad Health. The first is to save 100,000 years of potential life lost over the next decade. Over the past decade, we've lost about a million years of early life in our region. And, you know, that's really a simple calculation. And this data is collected nationally and really worldwide. Is you set a target of 75 years, and if you die at 70, that's 5 years of potential life lost. If you die at 30 from an overdose, that's 45 years of potential life lost. The great thing about that is this information is all collected through death certificates. You get a reason for death that's collected at the county level. And so it allows you to really take a look at where you're losing life earlier than you should in your region. And sadly, in our region, our rates of early life loss are much higher than the rest of the country. Our second moonshot is tied to that. It's a little bit different time frame, but it's to ensure that every child enters kindergarten ready to learn. And that's really the result of a community effort to make sure that every child in the region graduates high school, career, or college ready. We're interested in that because a high school diploma is tied tightly to income and education, which, as I said before, is very highly correlated with better health. The best predictor of whether or not you're going to graduate from high school, career, college ready are eighth grade math scores and third grade reading scores. The best predictor of that are, did you enter kindergarten ready to learn? And the best predictor of that is, did you have early childhood experiences where you avoided adverse childhood experiences, such as poverty, violence in the home, drugs in the home? But also predictors of being ready to enter kindergarten ready to learn are reading in the home and then high quality childcare. So we're making investments in all of those.
You mentioned on our pre-call that you have four North Star goals. Can you tell us about those and how they're driving your efforts?
Yeah, the first is become a model for rural health. And really the metric for that is reducing years potential life loss by 100,000 over the next decade. Also reducing the disparities within our market. So there's certainly disparities between our performance and the national averages, our performance and the state averages. But even within our 21 county service area, there's twofold differences in the rates of years potential life lost. And so we want to try to reduce that. A lot of it's related to being more rural or more urban, with the excess deaths really happening in our more rural areas. The second is become employer of choice. We're not going to be able to accomplish any of this if we don't have the strongest people possible and the right number of people in the organization. And so the simple metric for that is our employee survey that we do every year. Would you recommend this as a good place to work? And within 2 years, our goal is to be at the 50th national percentile, and within 5 years to be at the 75th percentile. So we're making a lot of investments in that. We want to be a high value organization, which means low cost, high quality. We already are one of the lowest cost health systems in the country. The measure of quality is an index of metrics, primarily from CMS. And then finally, financially thrive. And we think if we do these first three things right, the fourth will happen. And that's a target of a 4% margin, which will allow us to pay people sufficiently and sufficiently capitalize the organization.
You know, Tony, I love several things about what you've said. I love that these are quantifiable, direct moonshots. I love that you have principles that are guiding the organization and that you're transparent about it. But, you know, in many ways, all of our former jobs as secretaries were somewhat easier because we got our money from one source, the taxpayer, and then we could do what's right for the citizens that we serve. You have to get your money from third-party payers that sometimes have different objectives. They're not always aligned. They don't pay for the things that, frankly, you're talking about. I've never heard of a third-party payer paying for early kindergarten. There's no CPT code for that last time I checked.
That's right.
And, you know, I never heard of a payer paying for lives saved, right? And so how can you really run a system with your fourth North Star to be financially successful at a 4% margin and focus on things that aren't paid for?
Yeah, well, I mean, that's the million or maybe the $1 billion question, right? So, you know, our health system is the result of a merger almost 7 years ago now, and that merger was done under state action immunity. And so we actually have a contractual agreement with the state that allows us to be merged. And within that contractual agreement, we promised to do a whole series of things to make sure we weren't acting anti-competitively. But because it's actually monitored by the state departments of health, much of the agreement with the state is actually a public health document in terms of investments we were going to make in population health, and as well as moving certain metrics. And so, you know, one of the things the FTC worries about with mergers is that they never produce the synergies that they promise. And we took that to heart because we actually guaranteed the state that we were going to make $300 million worth of incremental investments in population health. To do that, we had to get the synergies out of the system. We had a lot of wasteful duplication in our markets, hospitals sitting literally across town from each other, 2 or 3 miles apart, in small rural communities that were both operating at 20, 30% occupancy and both losing money. That lost money was not being spent on actually improving health. It was just keeping these balance sheets subsidized. So we've actually been able to produce in the 7 years about $800 million cumulative synergies by, you know, making the tough decisions and redirecting a chunk of that money into these population health programs and shoring up the balance sheet. And so I actually consider that $300 million almost a population health venture fund, because much of what we need to make investments in, to your point, doesn't have a CPT code or has a long return on investment that hospitals typically aren't willing to make. And so as we go through this process, we're not simply standing up programs with this money and then hoping for the best. We're trying to either demonstrate their effectiveness and long-term savings in terms of cost for either ourselves or the payers, or we're trying to get reimbursement from the state or our third-party payers. And we've had some success with that. And we're actually in the 7th year of our 10-year investment cycle. And we think that most of the services we provide will demonstrate either a return or a reimbursement that at least pays for them. Not everything has worked, and so we've had some failures, but this is something that I think most organizations can do. I truly believe that 25 to 30% healthcare spending waste is the actual number. And so if we really dig in, we can take those dollars and redirect them to programs like this.
Yeah, that's wonderful. Looking back, what role did technology play in what you accomplished, and what is your view going forward with, you know, AI has been a topic of conversation, obviously remote monitoring, telehealth coming out of the pandemic. What's your view going forward on technology in relation to meeting your moonshot goals?
I think generally it's pretty important. I'll give you a couple examples, but, you know, having spent previous time in public health at the government level, my belief is the hardest thing to do is actually to connect with people. We, as a health system, I think we're talking a national health system, we tend to wait till people cross our threshold, right? But really, some of the people who need the most help are people who never come to your organization. So we've been investing in a lot of new technologies that allow us to better understand who's at risk, at a minimum in our patient population, but also in the broader community. So for instance, when people come into our organization now, because of some tools that we've implemented through Epic, Healthy Planet, Compass Rose, integrated it in with a closed loop referral system called Unitas, it allows our physicians, our nurses, to actually have a much broader view of the individual that's in front of them. And so as an ED doc, you might be treating a woman with a broken arm in the ED, but you're now able to see that in the past year, she's also taken advantage of domestic violence services in a member of our network, right? So that's really important, because you can have the perfect diagnosis and the perfect treatment in the exam room, but if the individual leaves and goes back to a situation that it won't support sort of follow-up, getting medicines on time, being in a safe environment, it's all for naught. And so we're really trying to get that 360-degree view of the individual. The other is, you know, just straight up medical technologies. Part of what we explain to our folks is that, hey, we're not just doing this public health type work. If we also do more of what we do well and do better at some of the things that we don't do well, there's a role for everybody in the organization to actually reduce years of potential life loss. So one great example is related to smoking. We're certainly doing a lot of public health interventions around smoking cessation. We've got about 2,000 people enrolled in a smoking cessation program. We now have about 500 people since the start of the program a few years ago that are completely smoke-free, 7 smoking cessation counselors. That's sort of more of a traditional public health type intervention. But we've also got some amazing new technology, robotic assisted bronchoscopy, that lets us actually take biopsies of lesions in lungs in parts of the lung we were never able to reach before with typical technology. And we've done about 130 of those bronchoscopies over the past several months, and we've caught 30 cancers in a much earlier stage than we would have ever been able to with our traditional methods. We're also, by the end of the year, going to have finished our technology security review on some AI technology that's going to allow us to take a look at all of our previous chest images to identify lesions in lungs that we might have missed that you just couldn't see with the naked eye. But AI technology, looking at it pixel by pixel, is going to be able to identify potential lesions that we've missed. And then we're going to be able to reach out with case managers to those folks and bring them in for services. So, you know, you add those things together and layer them on top of each other, service line by service line, you really can make enormous progress towards this goal of saving 100,000 years of life over the next decade.
Okay, so Tony, I love what you're saying. I mean, I love the specificity in which you can give the ways that you're doing this. So let's go back, 100,000 years of lives saved. How do we know how you're tracking the progress? Where are you on the journey? And how are you doing on that? How are you measuring it? How do you report out on that?
Well, it's really important to us that we actually be able to put metrics with these goals, right? And, you know, a lot of organizations have aspirational goals, but unless you've got a reliable metric, especially a community-based metric in this case, it wasn't going to help us very much. And so YPLL, the nice thing about it, it's publicly reported. You can go to countyhealthrankings.org and it's reported there. You can also take much deeper dives in terms of looking at reasons for why you have all these years potential life loss in your communities. If you go to CDC Wonder, it's a tool that allows you to dig in. And so that's all publicly available. So it's not just data that we can use internally that our board can see, but the whole community can see it, right? And so certainly under that, because of the way we identify where actually our problems are, our biggest problem in the region is years lost to cancer. The second, sort of a close second, is heart disease. In most parts of the country, those two are flipped. The third is accidents, accidental overdoses, injuries, and so on. And then it starts to go down from there. But that allows us to really, really target these. So we can set up for these individual reasons for early death. There's a lot of submetrics we have. So for instance, there's pretty good tracking on accidental overdose, right? There's very good tracking on neonatal abstinence syndrome. So we can, although we've got this big goal of years potential life lost, we're able to look at the submetrics on a regular basis. In terms of kindergarten readiness, state of Virginia actually has a kindergarten readiness tool, but there was not one available in Tennessee. And so we worked with all the school superintendents in East Tennessee in our service area and the Neiswanger Foundation, which does a lot of work in education here, and got everybody to agree to commit to using the same readiness tool in our service area. And then Ballad was able to provide the support to actually pay for that tool. So we're actually making pretty significant investments and just making sure we can measure what we're doing. Long-term, we've set up a longitudinal study called Strong Link in partnership with East Tennessee State University. That's actually taking a deep dive into the families' lives that we work with to see how we are affecting outcomes on a 20-year or 30-year process. We're sort of calling it our local Framingham study, right? And so we're invested for the long haul, but we also have data that tells us, you know, in some cases on a monthly basis, how we're doing.
That's great. Hearing what you're doing for communities and patients is inspiring. What lessons would you share with other healthcare leaders across the country that are working on similar rural health issues?
Well, you know, $300 million sounds like a lot of money. It's not a drop in the bucket, but it doesn't fill the bucket up in terms of need, right? So we understood from the start that we were not going to be able to go at this alone. And so from a community perspective, we've made a lot of investments trying to sort of break out of the community health need assessment box that most health systems operate under, which is, hey, every 3 years, we've got to talk to a few community people and put some data together to identify what our community needs from a health perspective. And most of the time, that stuff goes on a shelf. It's really sort of a minimum requirement the IRS has to be a not-for-profit health system. We've really gone well beyond that. First, we've taken that community health needs assessment process and totally integrated it with a very similar process that our local health departments have to go through. And so now we are working tightly together, and it's very, very robust and has a lot of community involvement, has a lot of public policy involvement. So it's a meaningful effort. We also provided the funding and really provide the backbone services to the strong ACC, the strong accountable care community. It's not to be confused with accountable care organization. And accountable care community is, in our case, is a group of 400 organizations throughout the region working in a collective impact model, working towards that goal of graduating children career and college ready. And, you know, those are organizations that include schools, faith-based organizations, businesses, healthcare providers, government, and everybody has different funding streams. Everybody has different governance models. To some extent, they have different scopes of work. But when you sit down in a room and you do the analysis and you do the conversation, you find out that we actually have many, many more of our constituents in common than you would think. And actually our scopes overlap in really important ways. And so everybody is now trying to row in the same direction and has produced really terrific results for the organization. That UNITAS closed loop referral network that I talked about was an effort of that group. So we can now see who is using all of our services throughout the region. Because of the work that group did, we attracted a $25 million TANF grant from the state to do in-depth case management and provide some cash assistance to families that were in deep poverty to try to move them to the next step. So collaboration with the community in a real meaningful way, which means you're not always in charge, is important. I think the same thing is true with physicians, nurses, and other clinical folks. You've got to make them feel a part of this. If they view their job as just to produce RVUs and deliver services, as opposed to delivering health or producing health, it's going to be hard for them to really understand why do I need to spend so much time and effort on this. And I think in our organization, we've done a really good job of making it relevant to folks. We have health improvement teams throughout the organization that bring clinicians to the table to talk about how we do more of what we already do well and how we do better at what we don't. And that's really, leaders have come from a lot of unexpected places in the organization to make that happen.
Tony, we both, Chris and I, really want to thank you. I think that this is really the purpose of why we do this podcast. First of all, congratulations. Second of all, we will continue to track your progress and really hope that you continue to be successful, because this is really a model for the rest of the country. And thanks for joining us today on What's Your Moonshot?
Well, thanks for your interest and thanks for everything you do to bring programs like this to light.
Alvarez and Marcel, leadership, action, results.
Chris, I thought Tony Keck really was a great example of having a clear, quantifiable moonshot. And, you know, what I loved about it, not only can you measure it, but it also is something that you can explain. When you focus on improving efficiency and reducing waste, where those funds are going to be used and how it's going to benefit the community. And I do think that is important to the workforce.
Yeah, their level of funding I was impressed with, and just their focus on making sure that that investment was well spent, you know, directly related to the two moonshots they had was it's admirable and impressive. And certainly they're benefiting the community and the people that live in it. So really an inspiring story.
I also think one of the lessons is that they've really reached out to community partners, to government, really pulled together a coalition. And that example of the early childhood tool that they got supported was a good example of that.
Yeah, and I think you're right. Being a prior secretary, you have a very different view. And you're able to leverage maybe what you know has been done in other states and bring it into yours. So really, really impressive stuff.
Great. So thanks, Chris. Really, I thought this is a really good one for our listeners, and we'll be seeing whether they have any feedback for us.
Yep, that's great. Thank you, Dr. Shulkin. Appreciate it.
Thank you. Bye-bye.